time for us to begin tonight, and I'm really excited about this class tonight. And I mean, it's a really wonderful portion of Scripture we're going to look at. And I'm also excited. That's one reason. The other reason is because it will be my last class before the gospel meeting, so I'll be happy to enjoy the gospel meeting and at the same time take a little break. It's not easy sometimes to dig into Scripture and try to find out all the answers, but I'm happy to be able to do it. I'm learning a lot, as you are, I hope. And tonight we're going to focus on John chapter 5, and we're going to move along, and tonight I'm going to try to do it verse by verse, and hopefully we'll be able to glean, get some teaching out of there. John chapter 5, and let me tell you first of all, before we start reading, about, it was actually September the 18th, there was a young man of 29 years old, and he's resident of Brownsville, Texas, but his parents are leaders of one of the biggest churches in my hometown. Actually, the biggest one, denominational church. And this, their son, which lived in my hometown as well, and their last name is Crow, they're from America, but they doing their work and they're living there. But this young man was found out flying a plane. He was flying the church's plane with the church's logo, and he landed in Louisiana, and the authorities just got in touch with him as he landed and wanted to do just a regular checkup, see how things were going, and he sounded very nervous. And this is the son of a spiritual, we can say, or a spiritual leader of many people back in my hometown. Well, they come in the plane, they found 15.6 kilograms of cocaine in the airplane, worth $468,000 plus a lot of cash. And that upsets a lot of people, how some sons of religious leaders doing this kind of thing, and how much their parents knew about it. And, people in my hometown were really upset about this, and just asking questions, and trying to ask questions. And as we're going to read in John chapter 5, this gentleman was caught, and two things happen when somebody is faking his faith. Either he gets caught, or everything just falls apart sooner or later. And this gentleman got caught, and he created a lot of revolt back there. But in chapter 5, and what I want to compare, Jesus is trying to expose fake faith as he's facing the religious leaders of his time. He's exposing them for our benefit, especially, first of all, for the benefit of those who were following them. And Jesus is doing us a favor. Instead of following the blind, he's helping us see who is real and who is not by exposing these kinds of fake faiths, as I'm calling them. So we are in John chapter 5, and it's been a year. We studied last time the cleansing of the temple, and that was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast. And now we're back in Jerusalem. It's been a year, and we skipped several accounts, but it's been a year since the cleansing of the temple. Jesus is back in Jerusalem, and he will be at the temple very shortly. Notice over there in the first verse in John chapter 5. After this, there was a feast of the Jews. Notice John calls it a feast of the Jews. And Jesus went up to Jerusalem. This had to be either a Passover, Pentecost, or the Feast of Booths. The three ones that were required for them to go. There were a couple of other feasts that they did in Jerusalem. One of them was the Feast of Purim. That was the one from the Book of Esther, where they celebrated how they were delivered from the when they were at the Persian government, and they celebrated that feast also. And there was another feast that came out during the 400 years of silence, during the Maccabean period, where the Greeks, there was a Greek leader, Antiochus Epiphanes, sacrificed a pig at the temple. You know, the Jews don't eat pig, and then it was a horrible abomination to sacrifice a pig. So they rededicated the temple after they got it back, and they celebrate that feast as well. And so, but most likely this feast, it's the feast of the Passover, as we try to research a little bit more and try to eliminate some other of the feasts, but this is most likely the feast of the Passover. And I want you to notice with me real quick how John, he points out this feast. Notice, our last time in 223, we read that he went to Jerusalem for Jerusalem at the Passover. So we have one Passover in the book of John. Now, if this was another Passover, this would be the second Passover, 5-1. There was the feast of the Jews. Notice 6-4, there's another year, and notice John 6-4. Now the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. Notice the similarity with the feast of the Jews with 5-1. Okay, now it's the third Passover. Okay, we have three. Now notice, where is the last one? 11:55 in John. We see the fifth feast. And the Passover of the Jews was near, and many went from the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. Okay, so we have four Passovers mentioned by John. Why is this significant? Well, because he gives us more or less the time of Jesus' ministry. It was at least 3 years, because we have three Passovers. Four Passovers. It was at least 3 years. So it was 3 years and so a little bit more time, maybe 3 years and a half or so. So John really points out dates of feasts. And we have seen this feast of the Passover. Okay, so it could be the Passover right here, 5-1. Okay, so they went up to Jerusalem for the feast. Now notice verse 2. Now there is in Jerusalem, by the sheep gate, a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porches. Now this pool of Bethesda is just right there close to, it's mentioning a door, the sheep door, the sheep gate. The city had gates, different gates, all the gates had names. If you read the book of Nehemiah, you will see a list of a long list of gates, and all have names. So this is saying it was by the sheep gate. I don't know if your version has the word gate in italics. Mine does, New King James. That means that the word gate is not in the Greek language. It was just added. So it's assumed that John is talking about the sheep gate. But nevertheless, it tells us the name of the pool. And notice, pools back in those days, remember, we're talking about 2,000 years ago, more than 2,000 years ago or so, and as far as this event. Pools back then were not like the pools we know today. We have a nice pool, fill it with water, clean it up and stuff, and then we fill it out with water from the hose or something like that. Well, guess how they filled their pools back then? There were no hoses, nothing like that. They didn't carry buckets to fill it up either. They made the pool to be filled up by a stream of water. Stream of water filled the pool, and this is what happened at this pool of Bethesda. This word Bethesda means house of mercy. And it reads that there were five porches, and those porches provided a place for those that were ill and crippled. So we have a lot of ill people by this pool of Bethesda. So there was a spring. The spring is called Siphon Spring, which is believed that was the one that filled that pool. Oh, were you going to mention something? Okay. Correct. Yes. That's true. Yeah, every time they find something new, it's according to Scripture and in support of Scripture. Definitely. Okay? So we're here at this place where the Pool of Bethesda is. And notice that since, let me just check back here. So, It was by this gate, okay? So notice verse 3. In this lay a great multitude of sick people. Notice, sick people, blind, lame, paralyzed. This was something probably hard to see, all these people are suffering. But notice, waiting for the moving of the water. Okay? It seemed like this spring was type of a regular spring. It could sometimes flow harder or lower or something like that, that will make the water do something funny. Like it looked like if it was moving or being shaken or something like that. So, but I'm gonna comment more on this, really soon. So this is, verse three. Okay? Now notice verse 4. For an angel went down at a certain time into the pool and stirred up the water. Then, whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was made well of whatever disease he had. Well, this is really nice. Growing up, reading this verse, I said, well, this is nice. An angel comes from time to time, stirring up the waters, whoever gets there first, and is healed. But we didn't pay too much attention growing up to this text, but if we study further, we're going to realize that this, in some version, if you have the American Standard Version, this verse will not be in that version. It is here in the King James. In other versions, it's on the side, as a side note, it's not in the text, but as a side note. And why is this? And also, the last part of verse 3, waiting for the moving of the waters. All that last part of verse 3 and all verse 4 are omitted from some of the best manuscripts there are. The best manuscripts do not have this text, this verse in it. So what happened then? Well, seems like after the apostolic age, one of the scribes tried to put on the side what was believed. Notice, what was believed that happened in that place. Notice there's a lot of sick people which have lost hope. They don't have any hope. And last thing they have is this saying, street saying. Well, if you go to the pool of Bethesda, notice the waters move from time to time. Whoever gets that first is healed. And that was a saying, that was a belief. So this scribe put that on the side, but later on it was added into the text. And then it just came to us like that. So, but also if we compare it to the evidence we have in the Bible, internal evidence, we call it what the Bible says, we're gonna realize that the miracles of the Bible are always connected with the delivery of a specific message. It's a message, there's a miracle. It's a miracle, there's a message. It's connected. There were not miracles just for the fun of it, and this wasn't like a miracle in the Bible. Also, there's something important to remember, that remember the 400 years of silence? There was complete silence, no miracles, to the point that not even John the Baptist performed any miracles. So, and then randomly there's a pool providing miracles and taking away the impact of Jesus' miracles. Am I explaining myself here? So, it is unlikely that this is what happened. It's just something that it was believed to happen and came to us this way. So, Jesus came and he's the one that impacted people with his miracles and his message. He's the one doing the miracle, not an angel. He's taking away Christ's message. So, we can go on this. I just want to mention that briefly. I don't want to focus too much on this. Now imagine a rich man. If this was the case that anybody who got there first was healed, imagine just a rich man having the means to pay for somebody to wait for them or whatever and take him real quick. That wouldn't be fair either. So just something for us to think about on this. Now notice, let's move on to verse 5. Now, verse 5 says, Now a certain man was there who had an infirmity 38 years. This man has been sick for a long time, 38 years. Who knows what his age was, but he's been sick for most of his life. Or who knows? So Jesus comes and John makes sure we know that this man is hopeless as far as his health concerns. He's been sick for 38 years. Really a sad situation. And verse 6, when Jesus saw him laying there, he knew that he already had been in that condition a long time. Notice Christ's knowledge. He sees him, he knows. He doesn't have to talk to him. He knows. He's been there for a long time. Which reminds me that Samaritan woman at the well, how Jesus knew about her without her telling her life. And he knew how many husbands she had, and the one that he was living with wasn't her husband. This knowledge, special knowledge, Jesus Christ. So same thing happened here. Remember Nathaniel in John 1, how he told them, this is a true Israelite indeed, in which there is no guile. And Nathaniel said, how do you know this? He said, well, I saw you under the fig tree. Just by seeing you, I knew who you were. So he sees this man laying there, and he knows how long he's been there. So, and then notice what happens. And he said to him, I'm in verse 8, do you want to be made well? Do you want to be made well? Do you want to be healed? And I was thinking about it, and I said, well, he's been sick for 38 years. Doesn't Jesus already know that he wants to be well? Why is he asking him that question? Isn't not that an unfair question to ask somebody that is sick? Don't you want to be healed? Okay. Correct. He has a purpose in what he's doing. He's asking them, questions makes us think. Questions makes us wake up. And just proof of it, if somebody is falling asleep, I'll ask him a question, or he's gonna go back up and he's gonna awake, I'm sure. So be careful, I'm watching you. Okay? So yeah, the question has a purpose. Jesus, what he wants to do and he's trying to do is stir in him, wake him up, make him think about this desire he has to be healed. Make him realize why he's there and just stirring up his desire to be healed by asking this question. And then, like I said, questions makes us think. Also, questions makes us say what we think about what's in our mind, rather. So, he wanted to stir anew in his heart the great desire to be healed. So, this question is for this purpose, to make him think, make him feel that desire to be healed. And I notice what happens, verse 7. The sick man answer him, sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, but while I'm coming, another steps down before me. So, it appears that the waters at this place flow irregularly, like I mentioned. And the popular belief was that only while the waters were moving, whoever got dead first was healing and received this healing. So that was a belief, and it's reflected on what this man is saying. There's nobody to take me there. So, verse 8. And I hope I don't run out of time. I mean, I finished my lesson so fast. I might be going really fast, but okay, notice verse 8. Jesus said to him, rise, take up your bed, and walk. I wonder about this. And I ask you, was this man expecting this to happen? Was he waiting for somebody to come and give him directions as to what to do to be healed? Did he know that who was talking to him was Jesus, the Christ, the Son of God? He had no clue. And then we're going to read later that he was asked, who healed you? And he said, I don't know. I don't have a clue who healed me. So notice how Jesus comes to him and he asks him to commands them. So, okay, you want to be healed? Okay, then take up your bed and walk. Okay? So, this is verse number 8. He gave him this commandment. And then what did he do? Verse 9. Let's look at the first part of verse 9. And immediately the man was made well, took up his bed, and walked. This man obeyed what Christ commanded him to do. So, evidently, this man has no faith before Christ comes to him. He has no faith. He's there laying down sick. There's no faith before Christ comes to him. So, even if there was a little faith, it was not a prerequisite for Christ to heal him. He's not coming to ask him, how much faith do you have? If you do, I'll heal you up. It's not a prerequisite, even if he had a little faith. So when did the faith begin for him? It began at the moment where he received the commandment, take up your bed and walk, received the commandment, and then he decided to obey it. And as he was obeying it, he found out that he was able to obey the commandment because he was the object of a miraculous power in his life. And that produced faith on Jesus Christ. And that's the purpose of the miracles, to produce faith on that one who's preaching. So now he has faith because he's been healed. And as he's standing up and he's amazed at how he is able to respond to that command, he realizes that, this is somebody special, and now he can have faith on him. But not before. Not before. Okay? So this is what happens to this man in verse number 8. Okay? Verse number 9. And immediately the man was made well, took up his bed, and walked. And notice John gives us a comment here. He doesn't want for us to miss the point. And he says, and that day was the Sabbath. He's mentioning this for a reason. That day was the Sabbath. So the Sabbath. In Spanish we call it the day of rest. The Bible version calls it like that. So the Sabbath, of course, was on the law of Moses. Let me read to you Exodus 31:15. Notice what it says. Work shall be done for 6 days, but the seventh is the Sabbath of rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day, he shall surely be put to death. Here's a commandment from the law of Moses. No work on the Sabbath day. No work on this seventh day. You're not to do any work. Okay, now the people of Israel are taken to captivity in Babylon. They spend over there about 70 years. And then as they come back and Nehemiah rebuilds, helps them rebuild the walls. And then later they rebuild the temple. Notice, let me find it real quick, what he commands the people. I'm going to be reading from Nehemiah 13, verses 19 and 20. Notice what the book says. So it was at the gates of Jerusalem, as it began to be dark before the Sabbath, that I commanded the gates to be shut, and charged that they must not be opened till after the Sabbath. Then I posted some of my servants at the gates so that no burdens will be brought in the Sabbath day. Notice, this comes after the time of Nehemiah. Okay, it's Sabbath day. But now I'm adding this thing. No burdens shall be carried on the Sabbath day. So you're not supposed to carry anything on the Sabbath day. But interesting enough, this came after the captivity. But interesting that according to the tradition of the rabbis, They were able, if they needed to carry a man in his stretcher or in a bed, like this man, they could carry him. He was a sick man. That was the tradition. But he was not allowed to carry his own bed. Just the bed. They say, if he's with men, some men are carrying him, he's laying down, okay, they can go ahead and carry him, but he cannot carry his bed, just his bed. Very confusing the way they had the tradition, very contradicting and very binding, where God didn't bind on those topics. So that was the tradition, and Jesus knew about this tradition and knew that it wasn't fair, it wasn't godly proven. So the Pharisees, okay, let me just keep on reading. Let me go back to John, because I'm getting excited and I lost my place. But we're in verse 9, and it was the Sabbath day. Okay, so we remember a little bit about the Sabbath day. Okay, verse 10. Then the Jews therefore said to him who was cured, "It is the Sabbath. It is not lawful for you to carry your bed." And we're going to see that this is not from law of Moses, but from their tradition, saying it's not lawful for you to carry your bed. Okay, so you're telling me that you do not mind the miracle that just happened? All you care about is that I am carrying my bed on the Sabbath day? That's all you care about? And notice, they gave him two options. Okay, so if it's the Sabbath day, I'm not supposed to carry my bed. What am I supposed to do? Okay, you have two options. Either you stay with your bed, right there where you are, until the Sabbath day ends. Just listen to these people. Or either you can go on, leave your bed laying down on the floor, and who knows, you're going to find it here tomorrow. Look at these people buying all these things on these poor Jews. And no wonder Jesus got angry very often at them and tried to expose their false attitude. Because these people were the leaders. These were the leaders. That's why I started with this illustration. Can it's not tolerated before God for a Christian to do this, much less to a leader to do the same. Okay? Now notice, I'm in verse 10. Jesus gave him another option before I go on. He told him, well, you're welcome to take your bed home, because you're going to need it later. Go ahead and go with your bed. Carry it. Take it home. There's no violation of the law here, as far as I'm telling you. So Jesus gave him that option. So very interesting how in the first visit to Jerusalem, as we studied in the last class, Jesus exposed the corruption that was going at the temple. Now in this second visit to Jerusalem, he's exposing the false attitude these people had. They already exposed by this miracle he did. They react to it and they expose their heart. They tell us what's in their heart. They don't care about being healed. All they care about is their traditions. That's all they care about. Yes, brother, please. Yes. Yeah, he was, there was a certain limit of distance I think they could walk. So he was able to move along if he wanted to, but carrying the, yes. Yeah, and they have their, nowadays, I had an opportunity several years ago, about 10 years ago or so, to visit a couple of, what they call Jewish synagogues here in the States. And one was what they call Orthodox Jewish synagogue. And, the word will tell you a lot of it. Orthodox, they will speak only Greek, so we understood none what was going on. And like a tourist, I had my camera, I was ready to take pictures, but we were warned, don't even hit the flash, don't even hit the bottom of the camera, because that's considered work for them, and that'll be offensive. So I was disappointed, and I had to put my camera off. And that's Orthodox as far as they go, even today. So that gives us an understanding of how they were. No, it's if it's an Orthodox, they will speak Hebrew. I mean, and if it's not Orthodox, they will speak English and sing some in Hebrew, and they'll mix it up. The other one that I got to go, it was everything most of in English, and I was able to understand what they were saying. But okay, nonetheless, okay, let's that was their attitude. It gives us a glimpse of how they were. No wonder Jesus had a purpose in mind when he's healing this man. Of all the men that were there, why not go heal a blind man? And probably nobody would have noticed. Well, maybe did, but he was not going to have to carry anything to draw their attention. But know what happened. Notice what happened. Okay, take your bed and walk. Okay, verse 12. Then they ask him, "Who is the man who said to you, 'Take up your bed and walk'?" They're not asking, "Who's the man that did this wonderful miracle to you? Who is this man, or who is this prophet who is doing this?" This sign, we want to go and see him, meet him. This is wonderful to behold. This is from heaven. No, they don't care about that. who's the one that told you to carry your bag? Violating our tradition. Or notice verse 13. But the one who was healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn a multitude being in that place. A lot of people, Jesus is not in the spotlight. He just walks away unnoticed. And before he notices it, he's gone. Where is he? Well, he's not here. And I don't know who was that healed me. So he left the scene. Okay. Now notice verse 14. Afterward, and remember, this pool of Bethesda was not far away from the temple. So he was close to the temple. But notice the first reaction of this lame man. Not being able to walk. Notice the first thing he does when he's able to walk. Where does he go? He goes to the temple. Straight to the temple. A beautiful attitude of this man. He's grateful for what he's receiving. And I'm sure you can relate to this. But I have found myself in times where I'm being really blessed. I'm not really appreciating the blessings that I have. And just getting angry at small things. And just forgetting about that big blessing. And I think it happens to all of us once in a while. And I say, how can I make my heart so hard that I cannot be grateful for all these blessings? And just get upset about really small things. But this man is teaching us a lesson. This wonderful blessing he received. And it happens, like, for instance, it happens in, for example, some people at jail. For instance, they hear the gospel at the jail and they receive it and they're baptized. What happens once they're out of jail? Well, they forget about everything. Some of them. So, we can be really, ungrateful sometimes. We is a good example for us of this man. So afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, notice, see, you have been made well, sin no more, lest the worst thing come upon you. Okay, maybe he's implying that he did something wrong, he sinned, therefore he received a consequence of his sin. And back then, they believed that if you were punished, it was either because you were an evil person. Most likely. And that's what they believe. Remember Luke 13 when Jesus is telling them about those men of whom the tower fell upon them. And as he's telling them, well, do you think you're better than them because the tower fell upon them? I tell you, no. That was just an accident that happened to them. It was not because they were necessarily evil people that God tilted that tower to fall upon them. It was just an accident. So I tell you, nay, except you repent, you will all likewise perish. That's what he tells him. So people believe that that's what happened. You did a sin. Same thing happened to Job. If we go back, they believed he did something really bad because of what happened in his life. But the important thing to focus here, verse 14, Jesus is not only helping him physically, he's helping him spiritually. He wouldn't be a really authentic care for us to help somebody just physically when we know they need some help spiritually as well. So Jesus is now telling him to be careful and sin no more. Sin no more. No more sin. Same thing in John. We're going to read in John chapter 8. As far as this woman that was brought, caught in at the moment of adultery, Jesus evidently saved her physically from being stoned. But that was not it. If that was it, then that would be pointless. Why save her if she's going to keep on sinning? But he went and told her the same thing. Go and sin no more. Take care of your spiritual well-being as well as your physical well-being. So he finds him in the temple, and he tells him to sin no more. Okay, now verse 15. Okay, now the man has seen Jesus. He knows who he is. Now he saw him a second time. First time they ask him about it, he said, I don't know. Next time he sees him, he notices him very well. So notice what happened in verse 15. Then the man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well. I found him again. It's Jesus. And this man, I don't know what his motives were, but maybe he had a simple heart, maybe a humble person. And he thought, well, maybe these Pharisees, our leaders, what they want to do is just follow Jesus. So maybe in a good heart, or maybe in a naive way, he goes and tells, oh, it's Jesus. And the answer, the result he sees is not, I don't think it was what he expected. Because they left that man alone, and now they focus all their rage and jealousy upon Jesus. That's the only reason why they wanted to know who he was. Just to harass him and try to make him fall. So this man tells him that he was Jesus. Now notice verse 16. For this reason the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him, because he had done these things on the Sabbath. So here we see the first indication of open antagonism towards Jesus from the Pharisees. John makes sure he notes that for us to realize that here's the beginning of this antagonism, of this fight between Jesus and these religious leaders. Okay, so the leaders, Jewish leaders, immediately began to persecute Jesus and they tried to make him fall and so on. So how did they persecute it? How did they begin to persecute it? Well, what they did is, in the first place, they refused the miracles he made. They refused his miracles or ignored him totally. And also they tried to lay traps for him while he was preaching. Remember, there were some commissions sent, even from Judea, from the south, all the way to Galilee, to ask him questions and just follow after him to see if he spoke any blasphemy or anything. And they also spread slanderous attacks on him everywhere these leaders went. So they also stirred opposition among the people against Jesus. This is the way they persecuted him. Okay, they were afraid to lay hands on him physically. They did not do that until after the last resource. Everything was exhausted. They went and laid hands on him and took him physically. But they were afraid because of the multitudes. The multitudes liked him, and they were not going to get him in front of them. Okay, so they persecuted him, and notice the opening statement. Notice what he says at the temple. He talks to this blind man, and then I'm in verse 15 now. The man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well. Verse 16. For this reason the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him, because he had done these things on the Sabbath day. Notice verse 17. But Jesus answered to them, my Father has been working till now, and I have been working. And we're going to finish only these two verses, 17 and 18. My Father has been working until now, and I have been working. This is the reason why I am healing in the Sabbath day, because even though my father rested on the seventh day, that doesn't mean he stopped working and he's there laying down forever. He works today. He sustains the world. Like we read in Matthew 5, he makes rain upon the just and the unjust. He is active today. He's working today. That's the reason why I am working, because my father has been working until now. This has been means began to work and it's continuing to work until now. And this is the reason why I am working, because my father has not stopped working. He works. He works even in the Sabbath day. Sustains the world on the Sabbath day. The world doesn't fall down because it's a Sabbath day. Has to be sustained. And God is working on that, even if it's a Sabbath day. And now, verse 18. But notice he calls him my father. It's very interesting, if we read in the Bible, that people refer to God not as my father, but as our father. They were very careful on that regard. They wouldn't even mention his name. And now this person called Jesus calls him my father. This is something shocking to them. Something they're not used to. And they understand the implication. They understand it very well. So verse 18, and as a result, this tells us that they understood what Jesus was saying. Therefore, the Jews sought all the more to kill him. Why? Because he attacked them, exposed them. First, he healed this man and sent them in the middle of the people for people to see him carrying his bed. And second, he says, my father has been working until now and I have been working. So therefore the Jews sought them all the more to kill him, because he not only broke the Sabbath, but also said that God was his father, making himself equal to God. And I cannot find, and there's other Bible verses clear, but this is one of the most clear verses speaking on the divinity of Christ. And it's being confirmed to us, not only by Christ, but it's being confirmed to us by Christ's enemies. The reason they got angry is because they understood what Jesus meant when he said, my father is working, therefore I am working. They understood that he is making himself equal to God. And if we keep on reading, we're going to see that, for instance, in the mindset of the Jews, the only one that could judge was God. But if you keep on reading, you'll see that Jesus said, God, the Father doesn't judge, he has given all the judgment to the Son. What? Say what? Yes, I'm the one who's going to judge. And also, if you keep on reading, he says that the Father gives life and raises the dead. And then Jesus said, I'll give life myself as well. So what happens afterwards, and if we're not going to read anymore after verse 19, is a wonderful sermon. If you want a sermon written, and it's a sermon there in the Bible, it's a sermon by Jesus. You go ahead and read it. It's a really beautiful portion of text as he's speaking to this at the temple. So the Jews understood what Jesus said, but sadly they didn't believe it. They didn't believe it, and that happens still today. There's many different doctrines that just undermine the deity of Christ and just put him on the ground, and he's just a man. And he's just an angel. Yes, brother. Well, this implies, as he's speaking of the Jews, as we're going to see, is the leaders, mainly the leaders, Pharisees or Sadducees, the rest of the gospel accounts tell us more about this, and it's Pharisees, Sadducees, and then mainly the religious leaders. They're the ones that are being jealous of him doing all these wonderful works. Yes. Either he was a liar or crazy, like say a lunatic, or he's Lord. Those are the options. Okay, any more comments? I see Lance very, very eager to make a comment. Okay, alright. Anyone else? Thank you so much for your time. I'm sure you're going to enjoy not listening to me for a couple of classes, and I'm looking forward for the gospel meeting myself too. Thank you.